This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. I'm Stan Grant. Later, what binds us when faith fails us?
But I think that what you're saying is total betrayal of what we believe in, and you think the same of what I'm saying, then it's just going to be impossible to have a normal democratic working out of our problems. And that is the great difficulty. Mm. Can we overcome? And the overcoming of that has got to be the acceptance, a real acceptance of each other. And it's that that we're really lacking today.
That discussion with renowned Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor a bit later in the program. First, though, the killing of Ayman al-Zawahiri, al-Qaeda mastermind and one-time chief lieutenant to Osama bin Laden. Yet another leader is gone, but the idea of al-Qaeda persists. Why? More than two decades of the war against terror and militant groups are still potent, still threatening, and at the heart of this is an idea of radical Islam that, more often than not, targets other Muslims. Amin Saikal is Professor of Social Sciences at the University of Western Australia. Amin Saikal, thank you so much for giving us your time.
My pleasure.
The news about Ayman al-Zawahiri's death, what impact will that have on al-Qaeda?
Well, certainly it's going to be a major blow to the leadership of al-Qaeda. But at the same time, as long as the Taliban are in power in Afghanistan, al-Qaeda will have a safe haven. And as far as I know, al-Qaeda has already established its cells in something like half of Afghanistan's 34 provinces. So al-Qaeda has been really growing since August last year when the Taliban took over.
I'm really interested in that, Amin. Why are the Taliban and al-Qaeda still so close?
Well, I mean, they have had the historical ties. I mean, as you know, bin Laden had moved into Afghanistan in 1996 when the Taliban took over Kabul. And of course, the alliance which was established between the Taliban and al-Qaeda could have not really materialized unless there was support from a major state or an intelligence service. And that was, of course, Pakistan's powerful military intelligence, ISI. And that alliance was very much based on al-Qaeda providing funding and fighters for the Taliban, and the Taliban providing safe haven for al-Qaeda and, of course, its leadership under bin Laden.
I mean, of course, we're talking about political organisations, but they are also faith-based organisations, or certainly use faith as part of their ideology. After more than two decades of the war in terror, why does this radicalisation, militarisation, weaponisation of faith continue to attract those and persist?
Well, first of all, it really thrives in the conflict zones, and particularly in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. These are open zones for these extremist groups to emerge. And the second thing is that the level of poverty, social and economic disparities, social and economic injustices, and everything else. And, of course, foreign interventions also played a very important role. And it's really created fertile grounds for these sort of groups, not only to emerge, but also to sustain their positions in one form or another. I mean, now we know that al-Qaeda is completely branched out. There's al-Qaeda branch in Yemen, there's al-Qaeda branch in North Africa, and they have been very active. In fact, I just gave a lecture on that issue, how active they've become in terms of hitting high-value targets and getting considerable amount of publicity. And of course, they still also remain very much active in Iraq and Syria.
There is a paradox, isn't there? Because while these groups present themselves as almost defenders of the faith, they also target Muslims themselves overwhelmingly. We must remember that Muslims have been the ones who have been killed in the war on terror, the targets of these particular groups, and so many Muslim clerics as well speaking out against this group, saying it is a perversion of Islam.
Well, as the ideology of the group, Ayman al-Zawahiri was the first person to justify the killing of Muslims by Muslims. He wrote a paper many years ago in which he said that for the bigger cause, it is permissible for Muslims to take care of those Muslims who are opposed to that cause. And that really justified the Al-Qaeda killing of Muslims, not only in Afghanistan, but also in many other parts of the Middle East.
I mean, he's an interesting figure, Ayman al-Zawahiri, as Osama bin Laden was, because he's a doctor. He comes out of an intellectual family. And many of the senior figures, many of the people who are involved in the 9/11 attacks, were university educated, many of them engineers. What turns someone like Ayman al-Zawahiri, coming out of Egypt, growing up with other people of other faith, to become a leader of this extreme Islamist group?
Yeah, well, I mean, al-Zawahiri belonged to the Islamic Jihad in Egypt, and the elements of the Islamic Jihad were responsible for the killing of President Anwar al-Sadat in 1981. And as a result of that, al-Zawahiri was tried and he was imprisoned, and then he left the country and joined bin Laden in Afghanistan later on. I think there is a very deep concern on the part of people like al-Zawahiri and, for that matter, his predecessor, bin Laden, that the West has been too interventionist and have been trying to really change the landscape of the Muslim world. They've been trying to usurp the Muslim world. I mean, this is their ideological position, and therefore it is their religious obligation to liberate the Muslim world from the yoke of the colonial past, as well as the imperialist interventions on the part of the United States and some of its allies in the Middle East. And I think that the US invasion of Afghanistan and the US invasion of Iraq, which provided them with more ammunitions and tried to really claim that actually the West is not only against our people, but against our religion. And the way they really turned around this whole idea of war on terrorism, that no, it's not war on terrorism, but it's war on Islam.
Amin Saikal, Professor of Social Sciences at the University of Western Australia, co-author of Islam Beyond Borders, The Ummah in World Politics. Thank you again.
My pleasure.
You're on the Religion and Ethics Report on RN and the ABC Listen app. So, Australians will vote in a referendum for a constitutional voice for Indigenous people. That much we know. But what will that voice be? What powers and functions will it have? What is its reach, if you like? That's not yet entirely clear. Critical, though, is the question of the place of First Nations people in our country, and sovereignty never ceded. That was the message of the Uluru Statement from the Heart 5 years ago, which kick-started this process. One of the key figures was constitutional lawyer and Cobble Cobble woman Megan Davis, also UNSW's first pro vice-chancellor Indigenous. Megan, I wanted to start with something that is in the Uluru Statement from the Heart and doesn't get a lot of attention, yet I think is fundamental, and that is the idea that sovereignty is a spiritual notion. Talk to the idea of spirituality and how that informs the Uluru Statement from the Heart and its call for a voice in the Constitution.
One of the things that occurs in Australian public life when we're talking about Aboriginal people, Aboriginal land, Aboriginal rights, is the emphasis is so much on property rights, on tangible property law, and everybody thinks of Aboriginal land as just the land, and very rarely do Australians get to extend that conversation. I mean, I think it's changing, Stan, but to have that conversation that's well beyond just property.
It's not a Lockean contractual approach to this. It's actually something that is deeply felt and almost immeasurable in terms of what you can write down on a contract in a property law.
100%. And I've said this on many occasions since the lockdown or COVID. I felt that Australians came to understand that a lot more, having been, you know, locked down and being deprived of what it is to feel the land beneath your feet. And as you know, there was this proliferation of welcome to countries and acknowledgement of countries via Zoom and Teams, etc. And I felt like there was this kind of national or at least deepening understanding of the dimensions of land and location as opposed to just all of the kinds of public acrimony over land rights and native title and all of those things. I think people came to understand better the spiritual notion of what sovereignty is.
And that's been reflected, do you think, in the shift and increased support, according to polls, for the Uluru Statement from the Heart, that people have reflected on the notion of community, belonging, spirituality, and maybe perhaps they're feeling more generous about those ideas after the experience of COVID?
I think people had to think about the fact that borders closed down and everything that we thought, you know, the kind of primary discourse about who we are as Australians and our nationality, which is very global, you know, when you can't fly and when you can't leave the country and when you can't leave your house. I think it was a period in which we had to reflect on, well, who are we in a very spiritual sense as opposed to the physical sense.
And that, of course, gets to the heart of what the Uluru Statement from the Heart presented, which was a new way of seeing Australia. And it, even though it wasn't explicitly presented this way, it reads very much as a faith-based document, doesn't it? The big questions of faith, of forgiveness, of reconciliation, of justice, of torment and powerlessness, these abiding questions of theology run right through the Uluru Statement from the Heart. You were one of the people actively involved in that. How conscious of you were that when drafting it?
Not conscious of that, because each line is drawn from a dialogue and it's drawn from a dialogue participant's mouth. But I would say this, Stan, two things. The reconciliation framework, which was severely criticised in the dialogues, has framed very much the way in which we talk about Indigenous peoples in Australia. And that concept of reconciliation, of course, is really fundamental to Christian theology. And, of course, we know, you know, that God used his son, Jesus Christ, to reconcile with humankind. We know all of the kind of fundamental theological understandings of what Christian reconciliation might look like. And, of course, the fact that ours is so asymmetrical, meaning it's more about non-Indigenous Australianness and not about the state as opposed to what it should be, which is Indigenous peoples and the state. I think that was really... Well, you're kind of forced into that space in some ways.
It also reflects who we are because, you know, a deeply spiritual people, and in many cases, in many communities, and you and I emerge out of this, and a deeply Christian tradition as well, which influences and frames a lot of those things. Much of the movement around social justice for First Nations people, as it did in the United States with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, did emerge out of those Christian movements, didn't it? The 1967 referendum. Very much influenced by that as well.
Oh, 100%. And that was the next point I was going to make, was to say that, you know, the invitation list to the dialogues around the country, the 13 dialogues, the 60% of those invitations privileged traditional owners and elders. So you had our cultural authority in the room, and many of them grew up, you know, in particular regions with very strong, not everyone, but many very heavily influenced by theology as a consequence of the reserve and mission era. And that cannot be denied. I mean, it can't be. It's deeply ingrained in a lot of the Aboriginal art, as we've just alluded to, a lot of the concepts that are deeply embedded in Aboriginal affairs, really. And so it does inform, I think, very much. And I mean, talking to you now, I can see that in the Uluru Statement. And certainly when we travelled around the nation, all of the old people who were actively involved in 1967 spoke to the fact that, you know, people often just talk about the unions, but actually the leaders in that space were churches. Mm. It was Christian leaders, and they were really at the forefront of this, the momentum towards 1967. And partly because of these kind of universal theological narratives of reconciliation, of sin, of guilt, of unity and truth.
But Megan, there's also a hard-bitten political reality here too. Frame for us what you believe that this democratic reform and locating a voice for First Nations people in the Constitution will deliver for Australia's democracy beyond just what it delivers specifically for First Nations people. Is there another layer to this democratically?
Yeah, there is. I think that is really the driving force of the Uluru Statement. I mean, it allows Australians to contemplate a more ethical democracy, I suppose, in that at the core of democracy, what we're trying to do is to ensure that the mediation of the tension between multiple visions of a good life is done in a safe way, a peaceful way, and that is what Parliament represents, and that it's done in a way that as many people as possible can have a say in who those people are that represent you in that parliamentary system. But we know from decades and decades and decades, if not centuries, of liberal democratic governance that the way in which we do parliamentary representation doesn't necessarily lead to good outcomes or fair outcomes. And we know that because the ballot box is majoritarian and therefore both political parties often pitch their policies to the medium. And the problem with that is small numbered groups and groups with really unique characteristics or roles within a state fall outside of that. And one of the consequences for us is that our vulnerability and disadvantage is made more acute, but less is made about our agency, right? Mm. And the voice very much is about amplifying our agency and saying, actually, we have the descendants here of a very ancient group of polities that have been around for well over 60,000 years. They still are here on this continent uninterrupted. That's a pretty unique thing in the world, and their voice should be heard in a way that enables the laws and policies that we project onto them to be better informed and of a better quality. And that's about improving our democracy, and it is about giving more integrity to our democratic processes, and that just makes for a better society in general.
Megan, thank you again for giving us your time. Much appreciated.
Thank you for having me.
Megan Davis, Professor of Law and UNSW's first Pro Vice Chancellor, Indigenous. We live in a secular age. Religion in Australia is on the decline as it is throughout the rest of the West. So what binds us if faith doesn't? Philosopher Charles Taylor has long pondered this issue. He is considered one of the most influential thinkers of the past century and is Emeritus Professor at McGill University in Canada. Charles Taylor, it's a pleasure to have you on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Good to be here. I'm glad.
I'm mindful of the recent census in Australia, where we're getting very close now to at least 50% of the population saying they have no religion. Perhaps in the next census, it will be a majority who say that they have no religion. To that question of the meaning of life, where is religion failing?
I don't think that you can speak of failing, because all the languages that we can offer, and there are lots of alternative language to religious languages, fail in that sense. If success is getting everybody on board, we've left an epoch in which this is going to be possible.
But why are people turning away in such numbers at such speed? And I'm speaking here specifically about the secular West.
I think that there are two things. Number one, even in the best behavior and best interpretation of the existing or previously powerful religions, you'd never have everyone on board, because it just seems to be in the nature of things that people's experience is very different. Now, this is compounded by the way of operating of traditional religions. Not always, but very often, they take the attitude that we have all the answers, you've got to listen to us, what we're offering you is a very strict code of life, and they behave towards their own believers as though if they didn't stick to this, they deserve to leave and go into utter darkness. So there's an element which is in the nature of things in the modern world, that no outlook is ever going to be unanimously held by everyone. Added to that is the manner of approaching this in certain churches or religions, the kind of panic. People are leaving. This is terrible. We've got to stop it. And how we're going to stop it is going back to the origins, to the most rigid and detailed form of our doctrine, and trying to impose that, which, of course, just hastens the exodus. When we reach some kind of equilibrium, ever we do, I'm sure it will be a plural society. Mm. But there will be this kind of flight out of the existing churches.
I wanted to ask you, in the face of declining faith, in the face of a sense of loss of meaning in a modern world of endless possibilities, what does the new atheism offer? The type of scientific atheism offered by the likes of the scientist Richard Dawkins.
I mean, total negativity. I mean, they're behaving like the most narrow proponents of some religion. They're behaving like Muslim jihadi in a certain sense, as though everything were totally obvious and any kind of sensible human being who isn't totally morally interested would immediately see that their theory is correct. We all have to have a certain amount of humility about the fact that not everybody agrees with us. We have to accept that the spiritual lines that we are following, which are very powerful and important to us, are not going to be evident to anyone else.
Do they not have a point, though, in pointing out, as they have, that God is not necessarily good for us, and pointing to a history of violence, and you've referenced that, the intolerance that exclusive religions can bring, that actually liberation from that may lead to a more tolerant, inclusive, rational world?
Absolutely. I mean, that's all the faiths have to draw the conclusions from this plurality, that this kind of total self-certainty and condemnation of outsiders is just not the way to realize the deep values implicit in their faith. But to have a group of atheists behaving like the worst kind of dogmatic believers just doesn't help conversation. I mean, they're not adding anything. To be in a perpetual slanging match in which everyone is saying, I'm totally right and you're an idiot or you're a criminal, is not the way to carry on some kind of attempt to live together through some agreement.
And Professor Taylor, that question of how we live together is what I want to take up with you now. You've said that society has been unhooked from polity and now floats free. How do we find order in a society, what you've described as a moral order, when we live in a world of contested beliefs and contested rights where we don't necessarily agree on even where we stand?
There are certain issues which we can't avoid. But there is some kind of very important general agreement around something like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1948. So much is it generally agreed that even those who violate it pretend not to. I mean, you have in China today the appalling behavior, you know, more or less, as it were, brainwashed Uyghurs into Han Chinese. And the government will never admit this. They'll say this is a lie. They don't say that we're doing them a favor by taking them out of their errors and illusions of Islam and turning them into members of this beautiful Chinese polity. No, they don't say that. They say this is all a lie invented by the Americans. So there's something very powerful here that even those who violate these principles don't really want to admit it. And the same can be said for Putin and Russia. So there is something there that we could build on. Only we have to fight back against those who would destroy this kind of regime.
You've mentioned China and Russia as two examples where there is this affront to what you say are universally agreed principles of human rights. But I want to look also at what's happening within, and I want to come back to Russia and China a little later, but I also want to look at what happens within democracies themselves. And let's look at a country like the United States, the home of modern democracy as it likes to present itself, which is incredibly divided, where there is a deep sense that people can't share the idea of a civic we, a common sense of purpose that is essential to democracy. Does it get to a point where a country is too big, too diverse, too pluralistic, too contested for that democracy to speak equally to people?
No, I don't think it's a matter of size but it is a matter of something very, very dangerous, because these democratic societies require some notion of common identity, what we're all about. And they require that because they require a lot of solidarity. You know, we demand a lot of solidarity of the citizens of our democracies.
What you've called a social imaginary, isn't it? You've said a common understanding which makes common practices and a widely shared sense of legitimacy. But if I look at the United States, I see a deep sense of illegitimacy. At the last election, of course, tens of millions of people did not even believe in the election result.
Yeah. I mean, that is the tremendous danger, that as important as this common identity is for the ordinary operation of democracy, because it underpins solidarity, when you get two totally incompatible readings of this as the two great positions offered by the parties, then it sort of becomes more and more difficult to have this common discussion and to have any kind of compromise. Because if I think that what you're saying is total betrayal of what we believe in, and you think the same of what I'm saying, then it's just going to be impossible to have a normal democratic working out of our problems. And that is the great difficulty. Mm. is it really going to be impossible to come to common agreements? Or are these big differences that are arising everywhere, not just in the States, but in France, we can go on with the examples. Can we overcome that? And the overcoming of that has got to be the acceptance, a real acceptance of each other. And it's that that we're really lacking today. All societies have lived with hierarchical understandings, men more important than women, whites more important than blacks, settlers more important than Aboriginals, and so on. And we've discovered that in order to have universal citizenship, we have to overcome those hierarchical views. A lot of people are deeply attached to them. And the question is, can they be convinced to abandon them and to really recognize each other?
Well, Professor Taylor, that is the question. And let me go to one hot button issue in the United States right now, and that is the recent decision by the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade. Now, in a society where people may have deeply held faith beliefs against abortion, vis-a-vis the rights of people to choose, women to choose and have control over their own bodies. How do you resolve something as fundamental as that in a society where you can't find common purpose, where there is this anger, where there is a loss of faith in institutions themselves?
If you look at various attempts that people have made in small groups to bring together people who are pro-abortion and anti-abortion, and they begin to talk it out, you find very quickly, if they just sit down and want to talk it out with others just as discussion partners, they reach some kind of common ground. Now, there's some differences left, but they're not absolutely black and white differences.
We don't find that now, do we, Professor Taylor? It is increasingly angry. I mean, you know, Hannah Arendt talked about who has the right to have rights. That's the fundamental question now, isn't it, in liberal democracies? And we can't agree on that, nor accept the outcomes necessarily.
That's what I'm trying to say to you, is that if you look at these small groups, it's obviously not impossible for people on both sides to reach some kind of common ground, in which there'd be still some differences, but not differences that are, in a sense, total, that don't accept for a minute the basic rights on one side and on the other side the same kind of riposte. It becomes very difficult when people are making their campaigns and getting the votes they're getting by precisely taking extremist positions. If the only thing people disagreed about fundamentally was the issue of abortion, that would be very difficult, but not something which you can't overcome. What is really difficult to overcome, situation in the States today, in which there's a whole raft range of issues, conservative versus supposed liberal, and which people have packaged themselves into rival views, which absolutely can't accommodate in any way the others. Mm. Now, it's not impossible to move beyond this, but it takes a certain amount of statesmanship and it takes a certain amount of savvy on the part of the electors. And I'm afraid that both these qualities are grievously lacking in the US. That's one of the problems.
Charles Taylor, philosopher and emeritus professor at McGill University in Canada. And we'll have part two of that interview next week. That is the Religion and Ethics Report for this week. Thanks to Mudita Dias and Hong Jiang. I'm Stan Grant. I'll see you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.